are broadcasting to you live from the shores of Lake Maspinock, where one rakes up mountains of leaves one day, and the next day there's twice as many leaves on the ground. Where the weather moves from a balmy 75 degrees one day to 6 inches or so snow the next. Where science, art, and philosophy meet in a kind of stone soup of ideas. And this intersection is called the Art Shed. Nice. Welcome, everybody. Oh, I'm Carl. Oh, crap. I'm Mad Carl.
I'm Normal Andy.
And I'm Producer Chris.
And today, we have with us Dr. Rick Wobey. Rick, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Rick Wobey. I am a retired scientist, a biochemist by training. I actually have known Carl for many years. We worked together at a little biotech. It was in Medford, Massachusetts. And then we got to Waltham and did a lot of interesting things together. And it's a real pleasure that I've been able to keep in touch with Carl over the years. I've always enjoyed his drawing. In fact, I'm sitting here in my office at home, and I'm proud to say I still have a personal... what do I call it? It's not a triptych. It's got five parts to it. It's a pentaptych that Carl drew for me way back when we worked together, of me sort of going crazy through the days of the week, eventually crawling into my computer, and then coming out on Friday a happy man. So anyway, that's me. I actually retired from doing work in the pharmaceutical industry back in 2008. And since then, I've been sort of been bouncing around doing various things. I taught high school chemistry for a while. Then I taught college chemistry for a while. And more recently, I've gotten involved in working with a lot of nonprofits in medical relief and in social justice, primarily. Addressing causes that I've really become concerned about, and trying to bring a little bit of my sort of business and maybe a little bit of the scientific point of view to helping nonprofit organizations manage their important work.
Yeah, Rick, you did a lot better job talking about saying your resume than I was going to. I just kind of had a brain freeze. I was going to say, like, Rick is a PhD. And then I'm like, you know what? Maybe I better just have Rick tell about himself.
Yeah, that's good. That's kind of like the opposite trajectory of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, right. Yes. Right, yeah. Reverse Breaking Bad. We have this tradition because it's Saturday. Well, we usually do this on Fridays, where we talk about the drinks we're drinking, to mellow out. Rick, are you drinking anything? You don't have to be.
Yeah.
No, I certainly am. I'm actually consuming some 200 proof water here with ice cubes in it.
So that's strong stuff.
Do you know the temperature?
it's equilibrium of ice and water, so it's probably right around 4 degrees Celsius or so. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Are you wearing your still suit while you not to bring back Dune? But...
No.
No, okay.
No, just jeans and a long sleeve t-shirt. Yeah, that's all.
Carl, what are you drinking?
So I busted out a homebrew called Kama Citra. And it's made with Citra hops and dry hopped with Citra hops. So it has multiple levels of Citra in it.
Nice.
And Andy, what do you got?
I got the Cat's Meow. It's a New England IPA. And it's from Exhibit A Brewing Company.
That's Massachusetts.
That's Massachusetts. All right.
Cool. I think it's Framingham.
It says 8 out of 10 cats say their owners prefer it. So I can't argue with that, really.
How about you, Chris?
I'm continuing my... mulled cider experiments, and right now I'm trying to balance out how much fennel to put into a mulled cider with some orange zest, star anise, cinnamon, fennel, And then, of course, Kubeb.
Nice.
Nice.
So just because now I feel bad, like with just my wimpy water. So I'll sort of indirectly tell you what I'm not having, but I have had recently, is a beer. So this is kind of a central Massachusetts thing. If you know Worcester, one of the most screwed up intersections in the U.S. is in the middle of Worcester. It's called Kelly Square. Well, there's this company, I think she was the Berkshire Brewing Company, Boston Brewing Company. I forget who it is. Anyway, they just came out with the New England IPA called Kelly Squared. And I've really kind of gotten to like this brewery because they have interesting names. Like, you know, this is one of the great things that a lot of these breweries have. And I first found them because they had this beer called Becky Likes the Smell. You know, what does that mean? And I have a very good friend named Becky, and so we've enjoyed that. So that's my contribution from nice. What you know, I'm not drinking right now.
Yeah, well, there's no shame in not drinking.
No,
I've been to Kelly Square, that intersection, and it is harrowing when you're driving through Worcester and you don't know where the hell you are. Oh. I've been to Kelly Square.
Yeah. It's whatever. They put in a rotary there now. So,
oh really?
It's totally changed everything. You know, because the Red Sox minor league team is going to be coming to town here. It's right next to that, so they figured, well, it wouldn't be good to have people dying right outside the Triple A team.
Day late, dollar short for me, man.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
But it's a good beer. It's a good New England IPA. I recommend.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
My first question was, what books or art has influenced you, Rick?
Mm-hmm.
Since you're in the art shed, so we figured we're good. This is a science episode, so because the art shed is about ideas. That's my new tagline, and I figured you. Since art and science, science is an art. We can ask you what art or whatever books have influenced you.
Yeah, well, I think I just recently finished a book by an author that I really really like. He's one of my current top two or three favorite writers. His name is Michael Sandel. He's actually a philosophy professor at Harvard. That has a fantastic lecture series. It's the most, I believe it's the most popular course at Harvard. He teaches it in the Sanders Theater there, which is this giant lecture hall that can hold 1,000 students or whatever. And the course is called Justice, and it's just about the history of how humanity's decided what the right thing to do is.
Wow. So
that's sort of basically the gist of the course. And so, like I said, it's wildly popular. So he just came out with this book back in October called The Tyranny of Merit, which is, and there's been a lot of talk about this in the past few years about how, you know, we all have this idea that meritocracies are good. And you know, meritocracies are based on this concept that, well, we ought to all be able to, you know, live in a society where we can come to the maximum of our potential and society should contribute to that. And this is a great idea. And that then when you live to your potential, then you should be rewarded accordingly. I won't try to recapture the whole book, but it goes into how on the face of it, that is a very good thing, but it ends up having particularly in American society, I think it's most relevant. It has a lot of unintended consequences when you start favoring, say, one version of merit over others. So let's just pick an example of like being really good with financial markets tends to get a person sort of a lot of credit in our society. And that credit comes through in terms of making a lot of money, getting a lot of social privileges, things like that. And there are certain things about that get pretty toxic pretty quickly, especially when the people who get that merit think that they earned it 100% right. on their own.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, yeah. Forget about the fact that there were teachers and parents and doctors and friends and social support networks and all kinds of things that got them there. That sort of gets lost. So that's sort of one thing people say, well, I did this all on my own. And most of us, none of us have ever done everything we did on our own.
Right.
And then the other problem is it ends up leaving, it in effect humiliates anybody who doesn't make it there, because now you're left to believe that, well, I guess I just didn't do my best. And the reason that I'm not as successful as this other guy is because I failed in something. And that's, you know, when there's so much luck that's at play here, that, and other things, you can't, you can't go too far one way or the other with that sort of thing. And yeah,
right.
We now have a big fraction of our population that is, over the years, particularly with globalization and the moving of many of our traditional industries overseas, it's ended up creating larger and larger portions of our population kind of feel like failures.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, you'd see on so many levels, it also stifles creativity, which thereby stifles progress in many ways.
Yes.
It becomes if all the money, well, it becomes monopolistic almost, that if one meritocracy, one approach towards meritocracy or towards merit, drives all of the money and the resources and the capital in one direction, it really takes the air out of the room for people trying something new and trying to experiment.
It does. And it does for reasons that none of us can understand. And yet we buy into it. Right. You know, like, mm-hmm. Well, how is it that financial managers somehow are worth 10 or 20 or 100 times more than your high school teachers? You know, where's the sense in these things?
And we all know now that the most valuable people are around the people in the supermarkets, you know, like fighting on the front lines of the virus, you know, like in the janitors and all that stuff. They're the ones that are the true essential workers.
Isn't that a tragic thing? Because look at what their salaries are. So, you know, like we sort of pay a kind of lip service to that. And yet it doesn't really pan out in terms of one of the key ways our society rewards which is their paycheck, or their healthcare support, or you know other things. So, there are all these things that have created this great unease in our population, and a lot of forces have sort of conspired to make people feel bad. And I think one of the points in Sandel's book is that this is what has made a character like Donald Trump appear to be a savior for these people. He says things that you know, that maybe they feel inside, or that maybe they struggle with, or at least he says things that help relieve some of that humiliation that they might feel. Well, right. It's not my fault. I didn't fail. It's those immigrants.
Yeah, he points the finger.
And so there's this real need that I think people have. Basically, the bottom line is it has helped me, I think, try to be a little bit more sympathetic, or at least understanding of people that I probably would just outright reject, and whether they're Trump supporters or some other group of people that they've got needs that Sandel's book helped me understand that they were there. I can't say that I understand them, but just knowing that those are there now makes the human consideration a whole lot more important to me. So anyway, it's helped me deal, especially with the past few weeks here.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's been a great a book that's been very influential.
On that note, you kind of I kind of had a pre-conversation with Rick, which we never have, but we talked on the phone and we got to talking actually, because we hadn't talked to each other in like 10 years at least. Oh no, you came to my art show, and that that was like 2000 and I don't know, that's 14 18? Or 15. Yeah, 18 maybe. So a couple of years ago, we'll just say. And Rick actually there, this is what made me think of having him on the show, because he has a really interesting story, which I wasn't aware of. He told me what he was doing, and I thought it was very interesting. But what I was thinking is that you could describe like the series of circumstances that led you to be getting involved in your Sam's project. Maybe you could say what that is too.
Sure. Well, so Sam's is short for the Syrian American Medical Society. That is an organization. It's based in Washington. It began back in the late 1990s as a professional organization of American doctors of Syrian origin. They wanted to have their own professional society, and they'd have meetings and talk about what professional societies talk about. Then when as things were leading up to the civil war in Syria, they decided to start taking action to help out people in areas of the country that were getting, I guess what would be the right word, persecuted. As I'm sure you all are aware, in 2012, the situation deteriorated very quickly. The big Arab Spring there. And it did erupt into, I think, a de facto civil war. And that led to the collapse of the healthcare system in Syria. Prior to the civil war, Syria actually had quite a good healthcare system. It was a national health service, sort of some similarities to what they have in Britain. So a single payer health system you maybe pay higher taxes, but you get very comprehensive medical coverage. And it was quite good. The doctors that were trained there, well, it's one of the reasons that SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society, could come up in the United States is that they were producing a lot of very good, highly skilled doctors who ended up going all over the world, including the U.S. And they wanted to have a little piece of their home country here in the U.S., which is what led to the formation of SAMS. So it was quite a good healthcare system in Syria prior to this. But then with, like I said, with the Civil War, then that system collapsed, and SAMS decided to change from just being a professional society to actually providing medical relief in the form of supporting doctors there, then sending doctors on missions there, and eventually building clinics. And I think right now they have, actually, I don't know the total number, many dozens, I have 50, 60 clinics around Syria. In the hardest hit areas, so in the areas that are not, so Bashar al-Assad is the leader of Syria. He's on the one side, people like around Damascus and those areas live much better because they're on his quote-unquote side. And SAMS was working in the areas that were not getting that sort of support.
So cities like Aleppo, for instance, or
precisely, yes, yeah, Aleppo, yeah. Idlib, Ghouta,
sure,
the very worst places. And now, just to give you a little bit of perspective, Syria, by the way, is a country. It's about, I just looked this up, it's about the size of New England, if you include Connecticut and Rhode Island and Maine and Massachusetts, New Hampshire and Vermont. It's about the same size in square miles. It's got about a 30% larger population. But you know, in general, you could sort of consider it to be kind of New England-like in terms of size and the density of people. So that's the country that's having the civil war. At the outset of the Civil War, you probably had, I mean, Damascus might be sort of like Rhode Island. So on the Assad side, and then maybe between Connecticut and Maine, those are areas that were also on Assad's side. And then the whole rest of what might be New England was in this state of warfare. And so Sam's was there to provide, they were trying to provide medical relief there. One of the things that makes Sam's, made Sam's to me very impressive was that the areas where they were providing the medical relief, which again, early in the Civil War was a big fraction of the country. Those were areas that some of the other major medical relief organizations, because of the violence there, stopped working. So Doctors Without Borders pulled out. The World Health Organization could not get into most of the country. So SAMS was the only organization that was managing to get in there.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry to interrupt your story, but how were they able to have access where other organizations couldn't?
It's a great question, and it's one of the, I think there's so many things I learned about life and how things really can work. Basically, I'm going to oversimplify it. It was connections. If you look at something like the World Health Organization, this is based in Geneva. It's a fantastic non-governmental organization, does a lot of great stuff. If you look, Doctors Without Borders, again, it's a foreign-based organization that works in a lot of countries, but they're sort of coming in from the outside. SAMS, these are people from the country. They have those, not just the formal networks that like WHO and Doctors Without Borders can work with, but the informal networks. They've got literally the cousins and the aunts and the uncles and the parents.
Right.
And this was really key to Sam's ability to operate. The tricky part is those, as I said, they were operating where the need was. The need existed in parts that Assad did not, we're on the opposition side to Assad, which made Sam's operations in effect a target. So I don't know what the current count is now, but I think that there was a great bit on 60 Minutes back in November of 2017 about Sam's. And at that time, they had lost, I think it was between 700 and 800 people killed by these airstrikes that you've heard so much about, where the Syrian Air Force and Army were specifically targeting medical centers. This is actually kind of a fairly common tactic that's used in many other conflict regions, where maybe you bomb a town, but then you know the people are going to start going to the hospitals. And so you do sort of a double tap operation, and then you hit the hospitals. And so this was, a tactic of war, as it were. So, and yet Sam's persisted and has continued to work there to this day. So that's the organization.
That's awesome. You should tell us about how you got involved in 2016.
So let's see now, what was that thing? Yeah, 2016, it's 4 years old. Something happened in November, early November of 2016. Oh, yeah, that was it.
It was my birthday, by the way.
I knew it! So this is all your fault. Jeez. Well, this... Okay. No, I was really unsettled by not necessarily the presidential election in 2016 per se, although that kind of sort of upset my view of the equilibrium of the universe, but just what led up to it. So much xenophobia, so much racism, and it was just naked, and people were getting away with it. And
yeah, and that had a huge impact on Syria as well. I mean, we saw it even before the election with the unwillingness to admit Syrian refugees, which really is horrible. I mean, you really look at Syria. I mean, I think before the civil war, and even still today, had some of the highest literacy rates, educational system there is superb. From a purely selfish place, it would make sense to accept Syrian refugees because they're very well educated, and it's primarily a sectarian, you know, it's a secular culture. In many ways, it was this country's improved greatly from at different points in history by accepting refugees in such situations. And it was just a missed opportunity and a tragedy on epic levels for the Syrian people.
Oh my God. It's impossible for those of us who've been lucky enough to live in the United States it's impossible to imagine grasping the scale of the tragedy there. And I don't want to get too much into the numbers because I'll mess them up anyway, but it's absolutely horrific. It has been compared to the U.S. response prior to World War II not admitting Jews to the U.S., even though there was plenty of very good evidence that the Holocaust was maybe not necessarily the Holocaust per se, but the massive scale of persecution was already underway, and we turned our backs there too. So it, So the thing that affected me, I guess, most immediately was the Islamophobia, which had been brewing, you know, since 9/11, and was, you know, for reasons I really don't understand, somehow got fanned furiously during the course of the campaigns that led up to the 2016 election. And in the course of my career, as a scientist, one of the most important things is that if science is true in Worcester, Massachusetts, well, that's okay, but it better also be true in Beijing, it better be true in Paris, it better be true in London, it better be true in Damascus. These truths that we're going for, if they don't exist everywhere, then you have a problem. And I had a chance to interact with scientists from all over the world, from the Middle East, every part of the world. And many of them had gotten to be my friends. And just the things that people were saying and sort of the budding persecution of Muslims particularly struck me. So this is before I started thinking about Syria. And then I don't know exactly what it was that happened, but then when the presidential election happened, I think like so many people, I was surprised at the outcome. But also just phenomenally guilty because I felt like I hadn't done enough somehow. And I don't know what it was, but that I had left something undone that might have helped. Well, I don't even, I still can't to this day articulate it, might have prevented
You kind of feel like your government, we're part of, it's by the people, and this is what our government is doing. You know what I mean? Like that's where it's like mass guilt. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, and that's it. It was very much a feeling of guilt. And so the Wednesday after the election, when those results were announced in the middle of the morning, I said, well, particularly with respect to the Islamophobia, this bothers me a lot. So I said, well, what am I going to do? I finally said, well, there's the Worcester Islamic Center. It's a local mosque here. And I said, well, I'll just go down there and go inside and talk to somebody and say something that will be, reflecting on my Protestant upbringing or Catholic or whether Christian upbringing, some kind of absolution or something in a mosque. I have no idea how mosques worked or how Islam approaches things like absolution and repentance and all that stuff. But I didn't care. I needed to go there. And it was a physical, irrepressible need to go. I walked in, met a wonderful man who I wept. I told him how awful I felt about this. I was greeted with kindness and love like I have rarely experienced in my life. I wish I could remember the Arabic blessing that he gave me, but I don't know Arabic, so I don't remember. But I just left feeling like I was walking several feet off the ground. And I said, you know what? This little personal absolution thing, this isn't good enough. I've got to do more to overcome, to repent, I guess, for my prior inaction. So that's sort of what got me started down the road that led me to working with Sam's. So there are a whole lot of other steps that I'll sort of cut through and get to the part where I started doing some volunteer work for several Muslim advocacy organizations. And one of my volunteer jobs was to go pick up a guy and be a driver to drive him to give a talk. And he was a doctor from Syria who was going to talk about the medical situation in Syria at a local church here. And he was doing the rounds. So I was the driver who was going to take him over to this Lutheran church up in, where is it? Holden, I think. Yeah, up in Holden. And he was in Cambridge. I went and picked him up, drove him there. We talked. He gave his talk. I drove him back. And we got to talking about what the situation was like in Syria. So he himself had graduated from medical school in Syria and was looking towards beginning a practice there when the civil war broke out. He escaped. The story of his escape was completely harrowing, too. But I was impressed by, impressed. I was struck when he was talking about some of the leading causes of death in Syria. And this was, 2016, 2017. And one of the leading causes of death was diabetes. One of the very highest causes of deaths was diabetes. Now, in the U.S., it's nowhere near that level of death. And so I got to talking with him about it. And one of the projects I had worked on while I was in the pharmaceutical industry was working on ways to prepare insulin so that it could be inhaled rather than injected. So I had some exposure to, how diabetes works, how it's treated, and enough to know that in the U.S., this is a completely manageable disease. So seeing people dying diabetes in Syria, it was astonished. So he explained to me what the situation was, the breakdown of the medical system there in Syria, and how this was now happening, that people were dying from this completely preventable cause. And so I said, well, heck, I know a little bit about insulin and diabetes. Why don't we work together? And that's when this Dr. Ihsan Kadan, who now actually is practicing in Boston. And I got to working on this project to see if we could persuade pharmaceutical companies to donate not just insulin, but also certain other drugs that diabetes patients need to maintain their blood sugar, as well as testing supplies and other things. And so we started on that in 2017. And I think that was probably right around when I must have seen you then, Carl, when I was just...
You told me about it and I was totally blown away, right? in the radio station. I was having an art show in the Worcester radio station and it's a jazz station. I paint a lot of like funky jazz art and Rick showed up. One time Rick said, if you ever have an art show in Worcester, tell me about it. And so I did, and he rolled in, and that was awesome. And he told me about his work, and I was totally blown away. And that was one of the things I was thinking of, like, I'd love to have like a scientist guest on the Art Shed and And I was thinking about your story, and it was like such a great story. Making something good out of a bad thing. You know what I mean? That's what I like.
Yeah, and I think also I love the fact that it starts out with, you know, looking at everything as such a huge big picture, overwhelming issue that you can't do anything about, and then reaching out just to make a human connection, and that, you know, by going to the mosque, and then that turning into a way to help out with the much larger situation.
So I have to tell you, and this is a little bit odd. Personally, I am not religious whatsoever. I sometimes play with the idea of labeling myself an atheist. Yeah, nevertheless, I think that there are things that we human beings do that create things that are bigger than us.
Absolutely.
And religion is some kind of way of expressing that and making it happen that we don't understand. I still sort of marvel at it. And I sort of, if I were to consider myself a religious person, I would say that the things that happened were miracles. It certainly has changed my life.
It takes you taking a step. You know what I mean? Like that's what I always say is action is, like an action, a good action today is better than a well thought out action tomorrow. I don't know.
Always say that, Carl.
I do always say that.
Every time I say
it. Like, I'm like very impulsive.
Yes.
No, but I take action. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and that you don't know where the next step is. And you didn't, you're not looking at a 3D chessboard, right, Rick? We're following your gut, and sometimes you gotta follow your gut.
You do, and you know, to be honest, the thing that has struck me is just how lucky I was. I think I came out of the womb knowing I was going to be a scientist, and even to this day, if somebody asked me, you know, well, what are you? I still identify myself as a scientist, even though that's not how I get my paycheck anymore. But when you are a scientist, generally, one of the things that's true is, you know, you're confronted with the unknown. If it's known, it's not science anymore. You have to go out there and say, okay, well, why does this thing work that way? Or what's out beyond the whatever we can see right in front of us? That's infinity, basically.
Yeah, right.
Those things are known only to nature. And sometimes you don't even know how you're going to know. But you just know that in the pursuit of that, just enjoying that pursuit of that, and it gives you a kind of, I don't know what, faith, guts. I don't know what the right term is, but it's almost like adventure, maybe. There's this unknowable thing, but it sure seems like fun to try to, or interesting or compelling to make it known. And I sort of feel like, you know, that's very similar to anything you want to do in life, whether it's, you know, look at a blank canvas and put a piece of art on it, or look at a human rights disaster and say, how can we make this right? You know,
right.
If the answer existed, it would be being done already.
Yeah.
Right. And it's also like your emotions are like, is your brain has crunched all this data. Mm-hmm. And it comes out in a form of an emotion. You know what I mean? And you can't put your finger on why you're feeling this, like, I need to do this. Yes. But your brain has crunched a lot of data that you're not that you're probably unaware of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really powerful way to put it, Carl. I think sometimes we spend so much time trying to rationalize why we should or shouldn't do things. And there was a term in business that we used a lot called analysis paralysis, where you just sit there and you think you can sort of psych out what the thing is to do, and you can end up talking yourself out of it. At some point, you cross a threshold where you just say, look, I'm just going to try, because the only way I'm going to really know what the answer is to launch into that unknown thing. Yeah,
exactly. That's science. Right. I mean, it's start the experiment and start getting some results and then adjust as needed, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Because you know you're going to be wrong. Right. I mean, that's I think I told Carl this, that, you know, one of my favorite quotes is from Thomas Edison when somebody asked him about, you know, his efforts to make a light bulb. And he said he had, you know, so far done like 10,000 experiments to make the filament and the light bulb, and they had all been failures. And the guy said, "What? You mean you've had nothing but failure?" And he says, no, I haven't failed. I've just found 10,000 ways it
won't work. Right, right.
Right.
And that's what you do.
Yeah. You know?
I got another good quote by Philip K. Dick. Reality is something that when you stop believing in it, it doesn't go away.
Yep. Well, that's very true, and I think the reality that I learned about with Syria from Dr. Kadan, that wasn't going away, and I lost a lot of sleep with it. Fortunately, he was game to try to put in some efforts to see what we could do, and it worked. The only way to guarantee it wouldn't work was to not try.
Right.
What are the results of the?
Yeah. So
of your
efforts.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the end result was, after spending about a little over a year going to various pharmaceutical companies. So this was one of the things I thought I could contribute. In addition to knowing a little bit about diabetes, of course, I when I left the industry, I was a vice president of research and development. So I had made connections with a lot of other companies and new people. I had, you know, could start making some phone calls. And when you work at small companies, which I did for most of my life in the pharmaceutical industry, part of the way that you make money is that you do deals with other bigger companies that then will provide funding for your work, or maybe you can license your drug to them and they'll develop it and pay you hundreds of millions of dollars and things like that. No matter what, there's a certain marketing aspect that you have to do. And that just involves going out and calling people and making connections and, you know, doing that thing like Edison talked about, failing 10,000 times until, you know, you stop failing. So that was a process I was, you know, very comfortable with, this idea of contacting people to try to get support for a program of medical interest. And so I just said, well, this diabetes thing is not all that different. And I started calling people. And after about a year of effort between myself and Dr. Kadan and some of the other people at SAMS, with their support also, we eventually secured through an organization called Life for a Child, I think is the name of it. I may need to double check on that, and we can correct that later. But that's an international NGO. Managed to work with them, plus connections I had formed at Lilly, which is one of the world's largest manufacturers of insulin. And between them and another fantastic NGO called Direct Relief, which specializes in getting medical supply shipments all over the world, managed to secure a shipment of about 16,000 vials of insulin. I always like to say it was 1.5 metric tons of insulin got shipped to Syria through this direct relief organization and then into SAM's network, which I didn't talk about, but it's SAM's ability to deliver, to do the logistics of delivering medicines would make FedEx jealous. Their success rate at getting stuff where it needs to be in 2017, for example, was 100%.
Wow. In a war zone.
In a war zone where people were trying to kill them. This is they're outperforming FedEx at on time, right. on destination deliveries. Anyway, and this gets back to what we talked about earlier about what makes Sam's successful here is they've got the connections.
Right.
They are of the country. And so getting the refrigerated trucks and all this, well, they just call Uncle John and
right. they'll
connect you with, you know, my grandfather. And so they got those vials there. That was enough to supply the Sam's clinic's needs for insulin for, I think in the end, they managed to make it last for a year. For all of the patients in their dozens and dozens of clinics.
Wow.
And by the way, just so you know, Sirius population at the time was about 17 million, about 10% of the population. So somewhere between 1 and 2 million people suffered from diabetes. Now, if you go through, you do the math, not all of them need insulin, but you're really talking about many, many, many thousands of people who were not getting the insulin and consequently having kidney failure, needing amputations, losing yeah. their lives. So these were lives that were saved thanks to the generosity of Lilly and the incredible work. And I, honestly, my only real contribution to that was just making the phone calls and doing some little thing that managed to get group A connected with group B.
Right.
And then stepping back and watching this magical thing happen. So that that shipment was sent in May of 2018. One of the nice unexpected benefits was that because I was talking to all these companies, I also found, I uncovered where they had supplies of a lot of other drugs. So antibiotics, cardiovascular medications where they had surpluses of that they weren't able to move. And so in particular, Pfizer was a very generous donor to this program. So probably if you looked at U.S. market value, I got many millions. I need to be careful here. Pfizer donated millions of dollars worth of other life-saving medicines, again, through this network that I described to you that we were able to use for the insulin as well. And so it was, you know, again, it was one of those things where you start out thinking you're going to do one thing, and of course it doesn't work. Then it sort of kind of works. And then all of a sudden it starts working in all these other ways that you weren't planning on it working, but it's, you know, you eventually tap into the right network of people at the right time. So that was that's basically where that effort led. I think probably the other thing that it led to, and again, I mentioned Sam's has such an impressive network for delivering medications and providing healthcare. They have since continued those connections. Sam's is now I'm out of the loop. Sam's is connected with Direct Relief. They're getting the donations. They're connected with the insulin supplier. So the network is now wired, as Great. It were, and functions, and it continues to help. A lot of Sam's effort now is confined mostly to northwestern Syria, which is back to like we were talking about before, Idlib and Aleppo, which are still encountering a lot of problems there. And it's good to follow this, and I've stayed in touch with some of the folks I met there at Sam's, and watching their continued success. So it's a story that continues on to today, even though sort of my part in it was done in May of 2018.
That's an awesome story. And
yeah.
Rick, I looked it up. It's LFAC, lifeofachild.org.
Yes.
So I'm thinking we're at the end of this podcast. I think you should just tell us your links or your plug. Plug your thing. I don't think it's appropriate to. Or do you want to ask another question, Chris?
I'm great. That was really great. Okay. Story, and that I really like how it's just you know it started with just wanting to make human connection and trying to do something on a small level, it has an impact on so many people and saves so many lives, half a world away.
And to link it back to the art shed, I feel like that idea of like just reaching outside your comfort zone to make a slight change is how like pretty much like everything interesting that has happened in my mm-hmm. life has happened, like where you just step out of your comfort zone. It's like stuff is just happening all over the place and people are looking for connections all over the place. And if you don't leave your house, you're never going to make those connections.
You might just sit in the shed and just broadcast out of it, though.
Right. Well, this might be a way of this is still a way of reaching out.
Right. So I don't think it's – I don't want to, like, us
– Yeah, let's not promote ourselves.
I want Rick to plug if you can think of what you want to plug, like the – I can put all the links in the show notes, but you can talk about what you want to plug, Rick. About your work.
Well, I mean, I think the organization itself, it's the Syrian American Medical Society. You can find them on the web. It's SAMS-USA.net. You can go to their website. They've got all kinds of information about how you can donate. If you know friends that are physicians that might be interested in maybe living a little bit on the wild side and going on a mission. By the way, they also work in Lebanon and in Jordan and Greece and Turkey and other areas where a lot of Syrian refugees end up going. So they also work refugee camps. So anyway, they're open to having doctors volunteer for these medical missions. We talked about Life for a Child, and the other organization that I am just so impressed with is Direct Relief. There are many organizations that work in this area of doing the logistics for connecting the medicines that somebody wants to donate, say a Pfizer wants to donate, connecting them with the places where the need is. So they've got the warehouses, they've got the shipping capabilities, they've got the customs and all the paperwork capabilities. And Direct Relief is one of the top organizations. There are others. They're all nonprofits. So consequently, they're always living on the edge. But just the work that they're doing as nonprofits is incredibly inspiring, both in terms of what it's doing for the good of the world, but also showing just how much good work can get done without a profit motive to make it work. And it's run, they're run as good businesses.
Why does everything have to be about profit, right?
That's a whole other very long conversation. I will crack a beer for that.
All right, I'm going to play us out with the Mad Cow Stomp. And Rick?
Yes, sir.
That was a stunning interview. We're going to win a Pulitzer Prize for this one.
Thank you
for coming. We didn't even do anything.
This was an easy one. We just got to sit back.
We just had to sit back and let Rick talk. Be the best.